Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Welcome to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm Matthew of CastingAcross.com, where I explore the quarry and culture of fly fishing. This is episode 195, and you know what that means. It means this has been done 194 times before today. It also means that in five times, it's going to be the 200th episode of the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. And just letting you know that after that airs, you can go into any fly shop and say, I listened to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast 200th episode, and they will sell you a fly rod at retail price. So that is a guarantee that you can do that. Today we're talking about a few things, but before we get to that, a couple more administrative notes. I hope that you're enjoying your summer. It has been a very hot summer, and so my fly fishing has been stifled a little bit, I should say. I talked about that last week in the podcast. It's just been just hot and low. I've been able to get outside, but even now I'm looking and everything is just dry and brown, and it really is putting a damper on getting out. But there's other fishing opportunities to be had, and I've been able to enjoy those. The ocean is still definitely a viable opportunity, and there are certainly fish there. But I hope that your summer is going well. I've heard from some folks about what they've been up to. Please let me know if you are just out and about, if you are fishing someplace that I've talked about, the Mid-Atlantic, the Northeast, the Arkansas tailwaters, the Driftless, you know, any of these places that I've talked about in the podcast, I'd love to hear about it. So let me know, Matthew@castingacross.com. And as always, if there's anything that you want to share, any questions, any comments, and as we deal with every 10 episodes, any accusations, don't hesitate to send those over to Matthew@castingacross.com as well. And if you are clicking on your phone, whether that be on your tablet or on your PC or on your device, then go ahead and leave a review on iTunes. Tap those little stars and tell the world what you think about the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast in 55 sentences or less. I think that's the recommendation that I'm supposed to give, 55 sentences or less. So you have a lot of flexibility in the commentary that you give. So thanks for doing that. And let's get into today's topic. Actually, before we get into the topic proper, I'm going to start with a story. So there was a creek that I fished a lot, probably in the times logged in my lifetime in the top five of streams I fished. And of a particular stretch of water, there was a couple of pools that I absolutely loved fishing. One, they were productive. Two, they had big fish in them. So there was lots of fish in them, and there was big fish in them. And so it was constantly a destination to try to end up in these pools. They were large enough that you probably could have two people, maybe even three if you were friendly, fish them at the same time. But it was the kind of place that it was below a little low head dam. There was a little bit of structure, a couple of down trees. The river went from being kind of slower to faster. So it was just a nice congregating spot for fish, but there was a trail that led right to it. So it was also a congregating spot for people. So to truth be told, a little anxiety when I would want to go fish in these pools, thinking, am I going to be the first one there? Am I going to be able to find a spot? But I would go there and I would fish these pools very frequently. I lived only a few minutes away from them. And, you know, this consistently catching fish on top, fish on streamers, fish on nymphs, any way that you wanted to catch fish, you could catch fish in these pools. So this became kind of a singular focus. And one night I was fishing an evening hatch. So it was kind of as things were starting to get dark, the bugs were really picking up. I'm fishing these pools thinking, okay, maybe I'm going to catch some of these larger fish as they are losing their inhibitions, as night is falling, as there's bugs coming up everywhere. And these fish that maybe are used to chasing bait fish and being predatory in that manner are going to rise up on the water column, and they're going to join in with all of their comrades as they feast on a veritable floating buffet of hatching mayflies. And so I'm casting and casting. I'm here splashing behind me, and I'm thinking, there's some idiot behind me getting into the water. He's probably, you know, casting right behind me, and I keep turning my head, and I can't see him, but it's dark enough, and it's up against the trees, and I can't make out what's happening behind me. And then I turn around, and I turn my headlamp on. I use the red light in case, you know, it is a person, and there's nobody there. And I'm just staring, and all of a sudden I see another splash. I'm thinking, is this birds? Because there's swallows that are, you know, chasing these bugs, bats and swallows and whatnot. And sometimes the swallows in particular would hit the water. And I'm watching it, and it's just this big, messy splash. And I'm thinking, oh, that's just some little fish. Well, then I catch a sight of this fish's nose and its back as it's rising to eat these fish. And it's in such shallow water that it's really breaching like a whale to rise to these mayflies. And it's this good 18, 20-inch brown trout that I'm watching rise, and it's only about maybe 10 yards, not even that, behind me on shallower water. So I'm looking at it and thinking, why in the world is that fish there and not here? Why is it, well, first of all, not where I'm fishing, and why is it in the wrong place? And so fast forward to the next day, because this hatch is just like, you know, fantastic. Come back to the same spot, and I'm there an hour before the evening starts to set in and the bugs start coming off. And I'm standing there, and I am looking at that spot. I'm on top of it. I approached it cautiously in case that fish was camped out there, but it was shallow. I mean, 6 or 8 inches. And I'm thinking, what in the world does this spot have to offer that fish? And I realized a few things. First of all, there's overhanging cover. So those bats and those swallows were not the only airbound creatures that were cruising the river in the evening. There was ospreys, and there was eagles, and there was all sorts of other stuff that was out there. Herons that would stalk the shallows. And this spot made it very difficult for those kind of creatures to get at those fish. Secondly, one step, one stride of mine in the water went from that 8-inch to about 28 to 32 inches. So we're talking maybe, you know, almost 2.5 to 3 feet. It was just a quick drop down into this trough that was directly downstream from that big pool that I was fishing. So I didn't put a tracking chip on this brown trout. I don't know if I caught that particular brown trout or not. But my theory is that fish was hanging out in that deep pool down under a rock, probably being predatory when it had its opportunities, when some dazed little fish came over that dam and it would go after it. But then in the evening, it would slowly drop back, and it would fin itself up into a good spot, and it will rise up over and over and over again to take those mayflies in a much more convenient opportunity. So again, that was my theory, and I think it bore truth. That was what was happening, not just to that fish in that spot, but that kind of demonstrated to me, and this is a long time ago, you need to read water. You need to take your time and get the full scope of what is going on. Was I fishing in the wrong place when I was fishing that big pool? Absolutely not. Catching fish, having a great time. But was that the only spot in that stretch of water that was viable? Definitely not. There was plenty of other opportunities to catch good fish in the immediate vicinity of where I was fishing. And so today, after, you know, a 5 or 7 minute anecdotal story to start things off, I do want to talk about reading water. What does reading water entail? We've heard that a million times. A couple of things that certainly we could talk about for hours and hours, but in the next 15 minutes, I want to share. whether you are a new angler that is really trying to get a grip on how to read water and figure out where fish are and where you should be standing and where you should be making your presentation, or you're a seasoned angler who is trying to categorize how you think for the intended purpose of passing it on to somebody, a kid or somebody that you're trying to teach how to fish, the easiest way that I like to break down reading the water is four parts. This might not be original to me. I can't necessarily cite somebody, but it's nothing revolutionary. Four parts. First, what is above the water? Secondly, what is on the surface of the water? Thirdly, what is in the water? And fourthly, what is on the bottom of the water? So looking at it from a top-down perspective, all four of those aspects matter. So let me give you quick examples of each, and I'll break them down. What is above the water? Are there trees overhanging? Is there a cliff? Is there an exposed bank? What's above the water? Secondly, what's on the surface of the water? What does the current on the surface tell you about that water? Is it going fast? Is it going slow? Is there a seam between fast and slow water? Thirdly, what is in the water? Is there a rock? Is there a tree? Is there a an old tire? You know, what do you see there? Fourthly, what is on the bottom? What is the contour? Is it shallow? Is it deep? Is it shallow too deep? Is it deep to shallow? Is it sandy? Is it rocky? Is it a large rock? Is it small rocks? So that is what we're talking about with this kind of fourfold paradigm for reading the water. And all of these are important because every one of them impacts the comfort level that trout have in any particular place, as well as their chances of being in that particular place for the purposes of feeding. Because I've said before, and countless people have said it before me, trout are really only concerned about safety and eating more often than not, and then for certain times of the year, how to make trout babies. But we're not trying to catch them when they're trying to make trout babies. So more often than not, we're thinking about fish have an eye towards safety and fish have an eye towards food. That's really all it comes down to. So top to bottom, one more time. Thinking about what is above the water. Why does that matter? In my little anecdote I shared earlier, that fish hung out in that spot because the larger predatory birds could not get to it. It was in the kind of place where a heron could not stalk it in a very sneaky manner because of how low the overhanging branches were. It is in the kind of place where no raptor, except for one with like Top Gun style maneuvering skills, was going to be able to maneuver underneath those branches. So that fish, in its wisdom, and I use that in air quotes, was positioning itself in a place where it could rise in shallow water with reckless abandon, feeling very safe. Now, there's another reason for this. You could have terrestrials dropping out of overhanging plant limbs, and fish could be keying in on that. It could be a slightly cooler spot because of overhanging shade. So if you have a warm stream and there's a spot that has shade later in the day, after the stream has warmed up a little bit, then that stream bottom is not getting as much thermal impact from the sunshine because it is shaded, and fish may gravitate to that spot as opposed to another spot where, from a water perspective, surface, what's in the water, what's at the bottom of the water is effectively the exact same thing. So we are thinking about how that is impacting the temperature of the water. So that is what is above the water. And that's something that you absolutely ought to consider. And it could be pretty high up. You know, it's not just the things, the branches or the rocks or the stumps that are grazing the surface of the water. We're talking 4 or 6 or even 10 feet above will make a difference. I know places where, you know, think about this. If you've ever fished for carp or fish under a mulberry tree, it doesn't matter how high that tree is above the water. As long as it is above the water, that's all that matters. And I found the same thing that's true with terrestrials. Now, to be fair, am I 100% sure that it is the tree that is producing the bugs versus the bank? I'm not sure, but you're kind of hedging your bets by fishing under something. So that's above the water. Secondly is the surface of the water. And this is nothing special, but I think this is probably the one that newer anglers struggle with the most, because you're able to see the bottom of the river very, very easily. Because, you know, especially if you have polarized glasses, if you're wading, you're able to see that. You're able to see what's in the water relatively easily. But reading currents, it takes a little bit of practice. It takes a little bit of, not necessarily practice, but experience. The more you are on the water, the more you're going to understand and appreciate the dynamics of water, of hydrology, how it works, what is happening on the surface as far as little riffles versus slick water and those little seams in between them. What that means is probably happening underneath. And even then, you're only scratching the surface, because there are so many dynamics that come into play based upon the what's happening upstream, what's happening downstream, and what's happening underneath. But you do get a window into what is happening in that water and in that current by paying attention to the surface. And that doesn't just impact, you know, are there going to be fish there feeding? Are there going to be fish there that are feeling safe? Can I walk there and be safe? It also is going to impact the variables regarding how do I cast? Where do I cast? What length of leaderage do I use? What diameter of tippet do I use? What is going to be the dynamic between maybe my top fly and my bottom fly? What kind of length should I look for having a dropper in this particular spot? All of those things are going to be determined by the speed of the water and the different speeds of the water in between you and that. Not very, very few streams, even like a channel, like if you were thinking of like a canal or a ditch that is perfectly straight, the water is not going to flow even on the surface at a consistent speed from one bank to the next bank. There is going to be different dynamics and variables that come into play based upon the most minute features of the stream bank and of the stream bottom. And then you factor in again what's happening upstream and downstream, and that blows everything up. So that might seem like a lot of information, but ultimately what it means is look at the water that's right in front of you. The water that is right in front of you, like in front of your knees if you're waiting. How fast is that moving? Now look 4 feet in front of that. Is that moving at the same speed? Does the water have a little bit more chop or less chop? Then 4 feet in front of that, more chop, less chop. And how about this? Does it look like from any sort of like bubbles on the surface or any sort of you know, minute disturbance? Is it moving in precisely the exact same direction? Is it moving in a perpendicular? Not, it probably isn't moving perpendicular. That'd be bad news. Is it moving parallel with what's right in front of you? Or is it moving at a slightly different angle, demonstrating that you have water that's coming from kind of two different directions that's going to be converging? And those convergent points are incredibly helpful, because that means that there's a funneling effect that's happening, where you have more content of that water from a, whether it be, you know, let's just say bugs, for lack of a better term, is going to be funneled into one spot. Now that is simplifying it to an insane degree, but reading those things really helps you figure out, if I'm going to be fishing in this very large stream, or am I fishing in a small stream, if I could fish spot A, B, and C, where am I going to fish? And you can see that in the glassiness of the surface versus the broken nature of the surface. And then you're able to see those seams, which we talk about seams all the time, where there are two surface characteristics that are running up against each other. And again, at the most simple level, what that means is that you have a spot where there could be more food flowing through at a faster rate, and a fish could sit in a slower pocket of water. So it's able to optimize its caloric expelling and its caloric intake by not using as much energy and taking in the most amount of energy. So that is the surface of the water, that dynamic. Again, so much more to say on that. But I've found that it really is just experience and playing with casting, playing with leader lengths, and coming to figure out, okay, this much split shot in this kind of current does this to my fly. Mending over this current impacts my presentation in this way. But at least just being cognizant. You don't don't have to have the right answers. You just need to gather the right data. And as you gather the right data of this impacts me in this way, fish respond in that way, then you're able to have the data that you need to make those adjustments, which more often than not aren't significant adjustments. They are minor adjustments because fishing is very intuitive. Nothing is moving in a way that is antithetical to the way that we move through the world. All of the same rules of physics are still in play, even on a trout stream. So above water, on the surface of the water, in the water. This might be, I guess, the simplest one. Is there structure in that water in the sense that there are large rocks or there are boulders? Now, those boulders are going to be impacting that surface current. And so you're able to kind of put those two pieces together. Ah, the current's doing this because there's this big boulder that's down there on a relatively flat surface. Is it gravel? Is it sand? And then it kind of gets to the point of being stream bottom. When I think stream bottom, I really think more of contours than I do about material or makeup. Is there a spot where there's a big pile of sticks? Why is there a pile of sticks? Well, that might indicate that that is a spot where there is a little bit of less current, where it's not being blown out. Is there a litter? Is there a tire there? Is there a barrel there? Is there a stump there? Those are things to pay attention to because fish key in on that. And it's also worth paying attention to because that's where you're going to lose flies. But, you know, losing flies and catching fish oftentimes kind of go hand in hand. So that's kind of the simplest one. Fish are going to key in on things that they can get behind, then they get in, they can get under. But more importantly, I would say bait fish can really key in on that. And when it comes to like leaf litter and sticks, bugs are going to go all into that. So whether it be fishing downstream of that or fishing in it, you're going to have opportunities to capitalize on food sources. Fourthly and lastly is the bottom contours. This is ultimately what made me discount the spot where that large fish was feeding in that opening anecdote. Because I thought, oh, it's way too shallow. Well, it is way too shallow under normal circumstances in a vacuum. However, the fact that it was right next to a deep trough that led to a deep pool made that a very viable spot when coupled with the fact that it was that overhanging cover. So those two kind of aspects put together made it a very viable spot to fish for. What? A big fish. So know your bottom contours. My favorite way to figure this out is trial and error by wading. You don't want to wade deep. You don't want to be unsafe. As I talked about last week, on low water events, get in there and figure things out. Figure out that, oh my goodness, this spot that I thought was deep is actually not that deep. The spot that I thought was shallow is not actually that shallow. This undercut bank is actually super undercut. You can figure those things at low water events. You're also able to take advantage of that. Different seasons, you notice when things freeze up, when they don't freeze up. But get to know the bottom contours because that has an impact on the surface flow. But it also kind of demonstrates how might fish move. If fish are generally speaking, moving from point A to point B, they're not going to take a straight line and they're not going to go across shallow. They're not going to go across, you know, rocks. They're going to stay in that deep, cooler, more oxygenated current. And that might be a place where they end up holding as if they're not the biggest frog in the puddle, as it were, between two pools. So get to know those spots. And those are also, you know, as you cast, you're going to want to cast into those spots so that your fly is going to follow the natural flow and trajectory of the water. If you want to fish the head of a pool, for example, you're not going to cast in the most convenient spot for you, which might be shallow, because that's not where the majority of the insects are going to be originating from as they move into the pool. It might work. There's always exceptions to the rule, but you want to follow the bottom contours and optimize where your fly is coming from. So the fourfold method, what's above the water, surface of the water, in the water, bottom of the water. That's a lot. I probably could have talked more about that. And I definitely could have talked more about that. But if you have any questions or if you have any thoughts about that, let me know. This should be something to explore later. Maybe break each one of those down in an individual podcast or an individual article. Nothing revolutionary. There are some great books out there on this, some great YouTube videos, all sorts of stuff that you could take advantage of to learn more. But as I said, when it comes to some of the most important ones, if I were to pick one, I would say surface, what's going on the surface. That's just experience. Get out there, do it. Play with different leader lengths, different casts, different mending, and you will start to figure out very quickly all those variables that you need to know so that you are able to make more, better presentations. That's some good language right there. This week on castingacross.com, the Monday article is called Fly Fishing Show 2022 Consumer Choice Awards. Now, this is really cool. So one of my favorite things about going to the Fly Fishing Show every winter and spring is seeing all the new stuff that's out there. And through a partnership with Angling Trade and Fly Fusion, I believe, the Fly Fishing Show had a online poll where folks were able to say what products impressed them the most. This doesn't mean it's the best. It doesn't mean that it's the best value. It doesn't mean that it's the most revolutionary. It's just what products impressed people most. So what that translates into is this is a product that has some buzz. And then you can go click on that in one of the 32 categories and say, yeah, this is kind of interesting. I'd like to check it out at my local fly shop. So it's just a cool resource and it shows you kind of the things that have a little bit of hype going behind them. And I'm not sure how you could quantify it. And I know that hype doesn't always materialize into actual results, but there is definitely something that's to be said for it. And so I would say check it out. I had a lot of fun doing it. And 32 links, had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of clicks off of the website over the last week, just people going from Casting Across to check out all of these products. So it's been kind of fun to see that. Wednesday's article was called Rusty Flybox, Angling Alliteration Absurdities. It's three posts, all of whom's title were Angling Alliteration. So it was humor articles, and each one I resorted to the cheap gag of using alliteration in the title. But as I write in that post, fly fishing humor is like the hardest thing for me to write. It's like my favorite thing to write, but it's also the hardest. It's easier for me to talk about how to read water, but because you can just do that kind of flow, stream of consciousness. But to write humor, you really got to think. So check those out if you at all have a sense of humor. And if you don't, then that's on you. This week's recommendation are life jackets from Astral. Astral is my favorite wet wading shoe, period. I have two pairs, the Brewer as well as the TR1 Mesh. Fantastic grip and keeping junk out. Love them. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about their life jackets. I fish with the Sturgeon. Now, this is a premium life jacket, but at the same time, as we've gotten as a family more into water sports, I realized that that's like a normal price, $150 for a good quality life jacket. And the Sturgeon is awesome because it is free, full range of movement for your shoulders and your arms. And if you're casting a fly rod, you know how necessary that is. That is the big difference between a premium life jacket and a $25 life jacket from a big box store. Those will keep you safe and they will keep you afloat. But when it comes to paddling and when it comes to casting, to have that sort of function and free movement of shoulders and arms and elbows, it is just something that you know, another $50 is definitely worth it. So I fish the Sturgeon. It has a big pocket on the front. It's great for fly box, some tools, cell phone, and you know, all the other stuff you can have hanging off of it, whether it be a knife, whether it be forceps, nippers, all that sort of stuff. There's spots for that. Lots of adjustment points. It fits me when I've got a parka on in the wintertime when I am duck hunting, and it fits me in the summertime when all I have on is a t-shirt. So there's the Sturgeon, and then there is the V8 Fisher. The V8 Fisher is a little bit of a different design. Doesn't have a full back and doesn't have one pouch. It has a couple of pockets on the side. Definitely check them both out. I'll put a link to the life jacket section on Astral's website on this posts page on castingacross.com. Thanks for listening to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. Please subscribe in your favorite podcast app and then rate the podcast in iTunes. Then head over to castingacross.com for three posts a week on the people, places, and things that go into the pursuit of fish.